Today on the 21st Show, the future of public funding for public broadcasting is at risk. Probably not, kids, because President Trump, his associate Elon Musk, and Republicans in Congress want to eliminate federal funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We'll listen back to our January conversation about how the system works, how much money is at stake, and what the end of CPB funding would mean for PBS, NPR, and maybe even the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. Now news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Many times when you listen to programs on PBS or NPR, you'll hear something like this.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you.
But public broadcasting is facing tough times. On Wednesday, the leaders of NPR and PBS are scheduled to testify before the United States House of Representatives Subcommittee on DOGE. It's chaired by Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. The hearing is titled Anti-American Airwaves, Holding the Heads of NPR and PBS Accountable. This is part of a coordinated effort by the Trump administration to investigate public broadcasting in America. There are parallel efforts, including one looking at whether station underwriting announcements are really prohibited advertising. It's been reported that our sister station, WBEZ in Chicago, is among several being looked at for that. This attack on public broadcasting was all laid out in Project 2025. We had a thorough conversation anticipating this on the show back in January, and we're revisiting that today. I should add, none of this is really new. During his first term as president, Donald Trump proposed eliminating funding for CPB. Here's some coverage of that from 2018.
From $480 million to zero, that's the Trump administration's budget proposal for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the organization behind PBS and NPR.
I spoke with the associate director of WYSU, David Lusher, today. He tells me that cutting public broadcasting dollars is an old idea brought up by nearly every Republican president since Richard Nixon.
Twitter CEO Elon Musk and Representative Lauren Boebert have called to defund NPR after its exit from Twitter yesterday. The departure comes after Twitter classified NPR as government-funded media, which the outlet said, quote, undermined public trust and its editorial independence.
And that last snippet of news may be a preview of what's to come. In 2023, Trump advisor Elon Musk on Twitter branded NPR as state-affiliated media, the same label used for Russian and Chinese government propaganda outlets. Worth noting here that at NPR, PBS, and member stations, we do not take direction from American or state government officials. In fact, some of us enjoy asking impertinent questions of them. Anyway, after Musk did that, NPR and many of its member stations, including the six stations that carry the 21st Show, stopped using Twitter or X. He has since demanded many times that NPR be defunded. Fast forward to the present, and United States Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana and Pennsylvania Congressman Scott Perry have already introduced legislation to end public funding of the CPB. But defunding public broadcasting means more than hurting Fresh Air and This American Life on NPR or Daniel Tiger and Frontline on PBS. In January, I spoke about this with Moss Brasnahan, executive director of Illinois Public Media in Champaign-Urbana, the station that produces this program. Our stations, WILL, FM, AM, and TV, are members of both NPR and PBS. Also with us was Jenna Dooley, news director for WNIJ, the NPR station serving Rockford and DeKalb, and a partner station of the 21st Show. And finally, Mike Jansen with Current Magazine, which covers public broadcasting in America. Again, we first aired this in early January before Trump was inaugurated, so some of the conditional or future tense in this conversation might be a little out of date. That also means we're not taking calls live today, even though you will hear from people who called in back in January. You can still let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. That's talk at 21stshow.org. All right, Mike Jansen, let's set a baseline. Since you independently cover public radio and television, what exactly does CPB do? Is it just one of those giant checks handed to stations? Talk us through how the system works.
Sure. So CPB receives an appropriation from the federal government and then disperses that money throughout the public media system in a variety of ways. CPB is, your listeners may not know that CPB is forward funded, which means that actually the decision made this year about how much money CPB should get is how much it will get in 2 years. And it's done that way as a supposed firewall against political interference, or to help diminish political interference. So, you know, every year CPB receives an amount of money. Some of it goes towards kind of system-wide initiatives and projects, and then a large portion of it goes directly to stations in the form of what are called community service grants. Stations, you know, need to be eligible for these grants in a certain number of ways, and if they meet those requirements, they can receive this annual grant. It's divided up so that 75% of the money goes to TV stations, 25% goes to radio. And, you know, the grants vary depending on the station size, its budget. Some stations are eligible to receive more funding if they serve particular communities, such as rural communities or Native American communities. And that's pretty much how it works. I mean, you can get down further into the weeds and it gets a little complicated, but that's basically the gist of it.
So how close did then President Trump get to eliminating CPB in his first term?
Not very close. He put out a budget proposing that he didn't actually entirely zero it out. It was supposed to be a small sum of money to kind of shut down operations. And, you know, it ended up that Congress did not go along with that wish. Usually it's the you might see in the House that there may be more of a push to zero out funding or to take away certain parts of the funding, because not only is there the overall CPB appropriation, but there are extra sums of money that go towards Ready to Learn, which is a Department of Education initiative that supports educational programming and outreach in public television. There's also a separate amount of money for interconnection, which is what helps programming be distributed throughout the system from, you know, producers like NPR and PBS throughout the country. So there are several different pots of money that can be decided on. And, you know, I think maybe in the House there could have been some effort to remove some of that funding, but the Senate restored it in the end and funding for CPB continued. So despite Trump's wishes last time around, he didn't get what he wanted.
Are things materially different as far as we know? Obviously, we can't predict the future, but how are you looking at conditions this time around?
Yeah, I mean, that's what everyone wants to know. And, you know, we're doing the best we can to get the lay of the land and to report the facts without being alarmist. I think some people are concerned that we are in a different situation than we were before. But when covering it, I'm trying to look at, well, how can we factually show that, you know? So one difference this time around, for example, is we do have DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, which Elon Musk, who you were talking about, is part of, along with Vivek Ramaswamy. And they are proposing defunding CPB as well. However, I don't think we know yet if DOGE actually has any power to do this. It's not yet determined whether any of DOGE's recommendations will necessarily become reality. And as for Congress, I mean, has the balance of lawmakers shifted enough that there would be more support for defunding? I don't really think we know that yet. And in the past, I mean, it wasn't just Trump's first administration, but, you know, other presidents have tried to zero out funding for CPB going back decades, as you were mentioning in your opening. And it's never happened. And I think a large reason for this is that even though some Republican lawmakers may at times take issue with, say, NPR and the journalism that NPR produces, that's kind of been more the punching bag recently. They see value in what local stations do. And also, PBS's educational programming for children, Big Bird. You've got local stations that do educational programming of their own, or they might even work with local schools to do outreach of that kind. You've also got I mean, there's a lot more to public media than just NPR's journalism, which certainly is a big and important part of it, but that's not all there is. Public broadcasting also does a lot for emergency alert services that people think is very important.
Yeah, so we can get all into that later. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, you add all that up, and I think it ends up being something that a lot of Republican lawmakers, even if they have issues with some of the journalism, they don't want to zero that out.
All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st show. We are revisiting our program from January on threats to defund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and therefore PBS, NPR, and local television and public radio stations around the country. This week, on Wednesday, the CEOs of PBS and NPR are going to be testifying before the House Subcommittee on DOGE, which is chaired by Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'm going to share a message from Tom in our texting group who said, "I believe NPR CEO Catherine Maher has an agenda and is pushing that agenda down America's throat. She has no journalism experience whatsoever, and she considers the truth a quote-unquote distraction. Government-funded media is dangerous when it's not impartial. If she doesn't drop her progressive agenda and cover the news without bias, the only response should be to strip away government funding." For what it's worth, Catherine Maher has been at NPR since March of last year. This is me talking now, not Tom. Thank you for that message. She says she doesn't sit in editorial meetings at NPR or tell them what to cover. And I can speak for myself. I've never heard from her. I don't think any of my colleagues have at the local level about what to cover. But, I mean, this is a concern that's out there. And I think it's shared by Larry in Olney, who's calling in on line one. Larry, thank you for calling in.
Thank you for having me. I wanted to preface my opinion with a little bit of my background. I'm a 25-year retired veteran, then went back to school and got an associate's in journalism. I saw a big paradigm shift during my time going back to school at the SIU in Carbondale because of the fact I was an older student. I am old-fashioned. I'm a staunch Republican, big Trump supporter, and I totally agree with the gentleman's text about possibly the CEO having an agenda, because us conservatives feel like on the liberal side, they're trying to shove things down our throat. And I think that's why Trump won this election, is because we've had enough of it, and there's strength in the masses.
All right, Larry, let me tell you, do you feel like when you're listening to NPR, you don't feel like it's fair? How do you characterize it? And maybe, I don't know if there's a specific story that jumps out at you that you remember, or a theme of coverage. Yeah,
I got you. I listen to things more with an open mind, even though I'm got my heels dug in. I like to hear both sides. My wife, on the other hand, she does not even like to turn NPR on. As when I was a child, Big Bird was good. Now the agenda with Big Bird and you know, things that we grew up with our childhood has done a 180 on us, and what was good is now bad. That's my opinion.
All right, Larry, thanks for calling in. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Moss Bresnahan, Executive Director of Illinois Public Media. Let me bring you into the conversation now. I don't know if you want to respond to Larry or Tom there, or just talk about how worried you are about the situation for the CPB and NPR and PBS.
Well, I think, you know, we welcome the discussion, welcome the debate, because at the end of the day, I think we can show that the investment in CPB is a great return on investment. And, you know, there have been calls for defunding in the past, and I think PBS and NPR have earned bipartisan congressional support for over 50 years for a very good reason. Public broadcasting provides quality programming, fair programming. 80% of the American public have shown that they support funding for the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. And when you get down to the role that public media plays in homes and communities across the country, it really is a trusted source for educational, thought-provoking programming, and plays a very unique role. And, you know, many people do think of PBS and NPR when we have these debates, but as Mike mentioned earlier, 70% of the funding for CPB goes directly to local stations, including a lot of the small stations carrying the 21st. And, you know, in this age of media consolidation, public media stations are among the last locally owned and controlled media in America. And, you know, in an age of the prices for cable going up and streamers going up, public media stations are available to 97% of the American people, free of charge, no paywalls, and the quality is really not up for debate. The quality of PBS is, I think, the best in science programming, the best in history. PBS NewsHour, I think, is a gold standard for journalism. And, you know, when it comes to what the local stations are doing, nobody else is providing the local news, the local cultural and arts programming, local agricultural news, tornado warnings. I mean, really, it is an incredible return on investment. And at some point, Brian, it would be interesting to take a look at the actual numbers because...
Yeah, and we can do that after the break, maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
Let me bring Jenna Dooley in before we go to the break in about a minute. I'm sorry, Jenna. But as somebody who is in charge of local news at an NPR member station, how worried are you? Why is CPB funding a concern to you?
Well, we talked about the breakdown between TV and radio, so 75% versus 25%. And so I wanted to mention, you know, our station is not a dual license. We are a radio signal. We don't run a TV station. So our reliance on some of those federal dollars is going to be a little different than those dual license stations. So the largest share of our funding is from individual contributions from listeners, about 40%. And we want to keep it that way because that keeps us accountable to the public. That caller is a big part of our funding model. It is not the government. It is people who value what they hear enough to give. Now, I don't know if he gives or not, but at the same point, if we lose the trust of our contributors, that is what I would be most worried about.
Let me reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. We are talking about efforts to defund public broadcasting in America by the Trump administration. We first aired this conversation back in January when what we knew at the time was President Trump had a history of wanting to defund NPR. Elon Musk was not a fan. And we also knew that Project 2025 laid out a plan, which the administration is now carrying out. We're going to continue listening back to this conversation after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. There's a blast from the past. We're hearing one of the first NPR News Magazine themes. We're talking today about the future of public broadcasting under a second Trump administration. My guests are Jenna Dooley, news director at WNIJ in DeKalb, Moss Bresnahan, executive director at our producing station, Illinois Public Media in Champaign-Urbana, and Mike Jansen, editor at Current Magazine, which covers public broadcasting. We first broadcast this conversation back in January. We're revisiting it today because the CEOs of NPR and PBS are set to testify this Wednesday before the House Subcommittee on DOGE, before Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. The title of this hearing is Anti-American Airwaves, Holding the Heads of NPR and PBS Accountable. We're not taking calls today because, again, this program was first aired back in January, but you can let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. Before we go on, I do want to bring another voice into this conversation, and that is from Fred Martino, executive director of our partner station WSIU, which is NPR and PBS in Carbondale in southern Illinois. It also has radio stations in Olney and Mount Vernon and TV stations in Jacksonville and Quincy. Before this broadcast, he told the 21st Show why taking out CPB funding hurts rural stations harder.
In a smaller area, you simply do not have the large number of options for corporate support and for philanthropic support as you would, say, in a large market like Chicago. We depend heavily on that funding in order to operate the stations. And I should say that is operating money. So it does not include money for capital support. As an example, WSIU recently had to replace the television transmitter in Quincy, Illinois, at large expense, six-figure expense. And that is not part of our regular operating money from the federal government.
All right, Mike Jansen, can you explain why there's no one-size-fits-all idea that sort of encapsulates all of public broadcasting and how it's funded?
Yeah, he was really getting at the core issues there. And to prepare for this, I actually asked CPB if they could tell me about how the funding breaks down per station, like, you know, station by station, what is the average amount that they get from CPB? So while throughout the system, for TV stations, it's about 10% of their total revenues, and radio stations is about 6% of their total revenue, that is by station. Rural stations depend more heavily on that funding. Almost half of the rural grantees, which is 120 stations, rely on CPB for at least 25% of their revenue. 33 rural stations, many of which are on Native American reservations, rely on CPB funding for at least 50% of their revenue. And as we were just hearing, rural stations have a harder time raising money from individual donors as well, compared to urban stations. Individual donations represent 28% of an average rural station's total revenue versus 40% for non-rural stations. So CPB funding is really more essential to them. And, you know, especially these stations on Native American reservations, that in some cases that may be one of the few, if maybe the only source of news for that area. Also, as we were just hearing, it is true that broadcasting and engineering costs can be higher at rural stations because they have low population density, but they also operate multiple transmitters to reach remote areas. And maintaining those networks of stations can be quite expensive. Some of that equipment is very old. I think it's generally acknowledged among engineers in the system that this is, we're at a time where there's a lot of aging equipment that needs to be replaced, and there's not necessarily the funding to do that. So for these stations, it can be 19% of their total expenses versus 14% for non-rural stations. So there are just a whole, there's a lot of different costs and conditions that rural stations face that others don't.
All right. And Moss, let me ask you how, I mean, put this into context and maybe talk about how this money actually works at the station, right? How is it accounted for? Are you audited? You know, do you have to apply for it every year? Talk about how this money actually functions at Illinois Public Media.
Yeah, so the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, they have a board of directors, and right now there are four board members who are Republican and four who are Democratic, and they have a rigorous audit system, both to make sure that stations are being fair in their coverage, but then also they carefully track the funding to make sure that it's used appropriately for station operations. And, you know, as alluded to, these funds are extremely important to local stations. I think when it comes to CPP, one of the things that really surprises people is what percentage of the funding is the national budget. So it's over $500 million that goes to CPP at this point. In a $6 trillion federal budget, that's less than 1/100 of 1% that goes to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So it's a relatively small amount of money, barely a rounding error when it comes to the federal budget. But when you look at the return on investment and the way it reaches 97% of the American public, it really is a pretty extraordinary investment in advancing education and the best that our culture has to offer and good citizenship. I think another thing that really surprises people is the way funding here compares to other industrialized nations. So it comes out to about $1.40 per person that's invested through the CPB. When you look at the UK, the BBC is funded at about $90 a person. In Germany, it's about $140 a person. In Japan, they have the NHK. That's $50 a person. And in the U.S., it's $1.40 per person. And so, as mentioned earlier, that funding is very, very important to stations. But even more important, that funding is matched 3, 4, 5 times by local stations. So I'd make the point that this really is a great example of a public-private partnership that works. CPB takes that funding, and again, through a very rigorous review system, provides support to local stations. But then they match it several times over to provide the local services, the local news, that stations really value.
All right. We have a number of callers who want to get in and mostly talk about this idea of bias, and I want to get to that. I do want to get through one other thing that came up earlier, though, that I think is an important point to mention, that it's not just NPR or documentaries or Masterpiece Theater that would be lost if the CPB was zeroed out. And Jenna, can you just talk a little bit about the role of public broadcasting in local and national emergencies?
Oh, I mean, I can think of very real examples here in Northern Illinois where we've seen fatal tornadoes and situations where people need to have access to reliable information, and terrestrial radio remains one of the most widespread and stable sources of that through our reach of emergency alert systems, as well as local reporting in the aftermath of those incidents. And, you know, it's 2025, so our investment goes just beyond towers. We have the capacity to provide low bit rate web streams if connection gets low. And so, you know, I'm thinking about recently what happened with Hurricane Helene. And we had hired a recent graduate from Illinois State University. And then he took a full-time job at Blue Ridge Public Radio and was part of that news team. And when power and local service were up for weeks, that signal was one of the few that residents could get, and it was a lifeline during the aftermath of that storm. And he came back and talked to our news team about all of the myths and disinformation coming in that area from outside actors. But people knew they could rely on their local public radio station. We are not startups, both in terms of physical infrastructure to keep people informed and trust in the community. His name's Jose Sandoval, and he talked with our team about how his experience and what he saw about how that information in that context and for how long that it lasted was life-saving.
All right. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are talking about the possibility, as we have been doing all week, of what the second Trump administration could mean for Illinois. Today, we're focusing on public broadcasting and the idea that funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is a significant but not typically a majority share of funding for most NPR stations, what that would mean going forward, especially here in Illinois. My guests are Jenna Dooley, news director at our partner station, WNIJ in Rockford and DeKalb, Moss Bresnahan, executive director at our producing station, Illinois Public Media in Champaign-Urbana, and Mike Jansen, who is an editor at the trade public media trade publication called Current. We originally broadcast this conversation back in January. We are revisiting it today. We did take calls at the time. We are not today, so you will hear some people calling in a moment. If you want to let us know what you thought, you can email talk@21stshow.org. Daryl is calling on line two from Springfield. Daryl, thank you for calling in.
Hey, how are you guys?
Doing well.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Glad to have you.
I'm actually calling because you had asked one of the users earlier if he had instances of where he had seen bias in NPR. And I love NPR because historically I haven't seen that. It's not a Fox News or it's not a CNN. It's very, very unbiased. And that's why I listen. But before the election, it got super, super biased. And it was all against Trump. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing on NPR. And so that makes me think that something has changed or something had changed, because I had never really heard that before on NPR. And then I heard it, and it kind of hurt.
I wonder if there's like a specific story or a theme of coverage that really jumped out at you in the way that it was approached, that stuck in your craw.
Well,
right?
It was everything. 2 weeks before the election, it was all anti-Trump. Everything was anti-Trump. I couldn't believe it. Every time I turned it on, it was, if Trump wins, it's going to be this. If Trump wins, it's going to be this. And it was all anti-Trump, and there was nothing against the other side at all. And I've never heard that. I've been listening for 20 plus years, and I've never heard anything like that until this year in this election. So that made me think, when the guy said that there's somebody new and maybe they have a different agenda, I don't know who the new person is. I don't know anything about that. I would never know who runs NPR, because that just doesn't interest me.
Usually not a household name,
It made me think about it. It made me think that maybe there is something different happening with NPR that I haven't experienced in the past.
All right, Daryl, thank you for calling in to share your perspective. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Let's go to Barbara in Huntley on line one. Barbara, thank you for calling in.
Good morning.
What would you miss about NPR?
Well, I would miss pretty much everything that you've mentioned. I'd miss the balanced news. I'd miss the news that's presented in context. I'd miss the honesty and just the quality of the journalists that present the news is important to me. I have to disagree with the gentleman that was just on and respectfully disagree with him. I understand what he is saying, but I also have the feeling that for so long we've been sidestepping some of what is obvious and maybe not saying what we mean or what we really feel for fear of rubbing somebody wrong. In my opinion, what NPR and public broadcasting was attempting to do as we got closer to the election was just point out the facts, the pure and simple facts. What we knew from reading from credentialed news outlets and what we knew from what we saw with our own eyes. And what we saw was very unique. And I don't know, I think that we need to be a little more forthright in actually speaking the truth. Just my opinion.
All right, Barbara, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it. I want to read an email from Lucinda, who said, I noticed the paradigm shift, the caller reference, that was the earlier caller, says, I'm a liberal center Democrat, 71, female. I did not appreciate the shift, but I still rely on NPR and PBS for most of my news. It is not Fox, and it's not Democracy Now. Pretty far progressive news organization for those who may not be familiar with Democracy Now. Martin is calling from Rock Falls on line 6. Martin, thank you for calling in.
Hey, I hope you can hear me.
Loud and clear.
Switch, phones. I just wanted to comment on that gentleman too that said that NPR and the public television and all that wasn't what he remembered when he was young. And I just want to remind him that, you know, public television is all inclusive, and same with public radio. It's not geared towards any particular political platform or statement. I mean, because I can remember a lot of comments, Democratic and or Republican. You know, it's not necessarily good for either side, and it's just based on whatever is happening in the news at the time. But like I said, it's all inclusive. I don't think it should be defunded, and it's like my mother always said, you know, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, you take the good and the bad, you know. So you gotta think about that when you do your funding, and if there's something you don't like, I mean, you know, agree to disagree. It's just the way it is.
All right, Martin, thanks for calling in. I appreciate it. Jenna Dooley, news director at WNIJ. I'm going to put you on the hot seat for this. You and I have been reporters for, about 2 decades now. How do you hear this criticism?
Well, I think I always want to remind folks, when I come in for my job, it's down ballot races. It's making sure that, you know, we have, for the first time in DeKalb County history, we are going to have a primary election for mayor, and that has a lot of nuance on why it's happening, what it will cost, how it will affect the general election in April 1st. And I think, obviously, we have coverage that handles national and international news, but the job of the local service that I am in charge of is making sure that voters have information on who's running for school board, county board, if there's outside influences coming into those meetings. And so we take a lot of pride. It's a lot of hard work. You can see studies from Northwestern University talking about increasing news deserts in Illinois. So that level of responsibility is humbling because we have a large geographic area and we can't be at every single meeting. And increasingly, other outlets are having to pull back outside of, you know, public broadcasters. Sometimes we're the only person in the room and we can't be everywhere. And so there is so much work to do at the local level in reporting, and our team is looking for those stories. And so, you know, if I go to an eval, what do you think about, you know, the election, or how was election night for you as a news director? And I think people think that I'm hyper-focused on the top of the ballot, when in fact I'm actually was operating in a completely different area of, oh yeah, this race was actually only separated by, you know, a handful of votes, and we're going to explain what happens next. And so that's what I wanted to show about, you know, if some of these markets, especially in rural areas, don't cover it, It simply will not be covered.
All right, we need to take another break. We'll continue listening back to this conversation. First broadcast in January. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
Hello. I'm Margaret Jo McCullough.
And I'm Terry Rialto.
And you're listening to The Delicious Dish on National Public Radio.
Hey, excuse me. I need to rent a car, preferably one where the radio is stuck on NPR.
Here you go.
Hello, it's me. I am returning.
How is the car?
Coastal and Superior. I never knew whisper talking was so smart.
The Antonin Scalia bedroom.
It's a National Public Radio broadcast center now.
Who are you?
I'm Robert Siegel, and this is All Things Considered.
This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and you are listening to how NPR has become part of the popular culture within the United States, with parodies on Saturday Night Live, Family Guy, and The Simpsons. Some of my personal favorites were on the show Parks and Rec. Look it up on YouTube. This week, the chief executives of NPR and PBS are scheduled to testify before the Congressional Subcommittee on DOGE. That's this Wednesday, chaired by Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. The title of the hearing is Anti-American Airwaves, Holding the Heads of NPR and PBS Accountable. In anticipation of that, we are listening back to our January conversation on the threats to public broadcasting under the second Trump administration. My guests were Jenna Dooley, news director at WNIJ in DeKalb, Moss Bresnahan, executive director at our producing station, Illinois Public Media, in Champaign-Urbana, and Mike Jansen, editor at Current Magazine, which covers public broadcasting. Because we're on tape, no phone calls, but you can email us, talk@21stshow.org. Terry emailed, from Melbourne, Florida, listening, said, please keep the funding for NPR in place. There are hardly any commercial radio stations that provide anything like the balance and objectivity of NPR. The fairness doctrine is no longer there to assure a semblance of fairness in commercial radio. Our local communities rely on public radio as sometimes the only source of local affairs on the airwaves. I take issue with a caller who criticizes NPR for not talking favorably of Trump. If Trump or Biden or others are wrong, they should be called on it. It's not the responsibility of NPR to defend every crank politician who comes along, including convicted felons. Thank you for that message, Terry. We also heard from Kevin in Farina, Illinois. Over 50% of the media I consume is public-based. You can't beat the quality and integrity of the programming. Not sure how to survive possible defunding, hoping it doesn't happen. And yes, I financially support what I consume. Moss, let me ask you about this idea of bias. I'm sure you hear this. I know you meet with members of Congress from both sides of the aisle. How do you respond to that when you hear this critique?
Well, I think the important thing is not to be defensive and to take a look at the programs and get the facts. And ultimately, when we do, I mean, I think NPR is one of the premier news organizations in the country. I think PBS NewsHour is the gold standard in journalism. But NPR does make mistakes. And so I think it's important to look at it and acknowledge it. And, you know, NPR does have a public editor, Kelly McBride. And if for people interested, they can go to the NPR website and look at some of the work that she does. And she responds to some criticisms. And she's supported by researchers and the Poynter Institute. And sometimes she'll research the complaints and there'll be something to them. And other times she'll be able to explain why the decisions were made. But ultimately, I think that the things that I hear have more to do with story selection than bias within the stories. And so that's always, an interesting discussion. But one thing I would make is that
A good point. And maybe we should just pause on that for a moment, because it's something like, a newspaper might have an outdoors editor or a magazine that covers hunting or something like that. Probably not as many people hunt at NPR or member stations as in the general population, although that may not be true if it's stations in Montana or something like that. But that's where you get into, like, what are the sort of things that the reporters are pursuing, right? That's story selection.
That's right. And I think on any given day, the stories on NPR would be very different than the stories covered by Fox News. And so, I think they're chosen for very different reasons. We're not driven by the need to drive up ratings. And so the story selection for public media is quite a bit different than those that might be seeking stories that are, you know, stoking outrage or, you know, really appealing to a partisan audience.
Jenna Dooley, how do you think about that story selection when you and your reporters are deciding what to cover?
So the example would be for the election. We partnered with a national group that had received some funding from Corporation for Public Broadcasting called America Amplified. And America Amplified was an engagement-first model. So I didn't sit with my news team and say, okay, well, what are we going to cover for the election? Instead, it relied on starting with live events, voter listening sessions. We partnered with the League of Women Voters, who were holding some of these sessions. And it was all around three core questions to ask people of where do you get your news and information? What issues are important to you? And what do you think reporters can do better about the coverage? And so we asked those questions, and that informed our story selection because it talked about, and we did it with different groups. We held one at Northern Illinois University to get that pulse from students. We also did it in different parts of our region. And it was really enlightening to say, oh, wow, these topics are really important, or we didn't know that this race was as contentious. Maybe, you know, we really should do a profile on that. So that engagement first focus, I will tell you, it is much harder front end work. It yields better stories. But I will tell you, you know, I mentioned outside actors can work a lot faster than engagement. If you want to, you know, come up with stories that are not fake or not done by a local or reputable news organization. But we're willing to take that time because, again, our value proposition is when you turn on the air and you give your personal dollars and investment that you see the level of quality and you're willing to continue to do that.
I think one point I'd make too, Brian, is that most of our programming has nothing to do with news and public affairs. I mean, we are keeping classical music alive. We have a whole channel devoted to that. When you think about programs like, you know, Fresh Air or Science Friday or This American Life or Splendid Table, those are really, you know, signature programs. And then I have to just remind folks that for the 50% of kids who don't attend preschool, public media is out there helping them to get ready to learn through PBS Kids. And I think offering a safe space for children to be educated and entertained is a social benefit that's embraced across the ideological spectrum. It's really, you know, even more important in this day and age, considering the scrutiny that social media companies are under now, too. So that role that PBS Kids plays is still very, very important.
So little time left. I do want to get a couple more callers in at 800-222-9455. Pam, you have been waiting from Red State, Iowa on line two. Pam, thank you for calling in.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate that. I love NPR and think you do overall a fabulous job. We're all human, so expecting perfection, I think, is unrealistic. I wasn't going to call in until I heard the man saying, well, 2 weeks before the election, you were biased. And I'm like, no, I thought they were finally catching up. I think they had been too kind to Trump before that. And so I question whether he had read any of Project 2025. I think for those of us that had read even part of that, my hair was more on fire than it had been before I read part of it. So I would encourage him, if he hasn't looked at that, to read that.
Well, Pam, go ahead.
Document.
All right, Pam, anyway. Thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it. Let's see if we can get another couple of callers here. Mike from Oglesby on line six. Mike, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, I teach at the local community college, Illinois Valley Community College, and I consider myself a community geologist. Our local newsrooms have really, like at the local newspapers, have really been decimated, but WNIJ is just a standout. And I've had the opportunity to work with Jenna and some of her colleagues at WNIJ to provide relevant local information on issues where geology can provide important context, including natural hazards, resources, human impacts on the environment. I helped with a story on sinkholes and mining in Northern Illinois this past fall. And I just really appreciate that local focus and the ability to help keep our local and community informed about these issues.
All right, Mike.
I want to jump. Oh,
yeah, go ahead,
you know,
Jenna.
Mike,
go ahead.
We had an earthquake here in Northern Illinois, and that day, you know, breaking news. And the first person I thought of, you know what? Mike is a geologist at Illinois Valley Community College, and he was right near the epicenter and also has that degree to inform our listeners of what it was. So again, it's that daily coverage, that context coverage, and breaking news to have people right here, literally like on the ground in Northern Illinois when those news items hit. Thanks for calling, Mike.
Yeah, thank you for that, Mike. All right, we only have about 5 minutes left in our time together. Mike Jansen, I want to come back to you. We didn't really even get to talk about Brandon Carr, Trump's pick to lead the FCC, but I guess take it where you will. What are you going to be watching for after Trump takes the oath of office in about a week and a half from now?
Yeah, well, if you want to talk about Brandon Carr, we can bring that up. We just heard about Project 2025. Carr reportedly wrote the section of Project 2025, the Heritage Foundation plan, game plan, basically, that argues for defunding of public broadcasting and other policy changes. And now, Trump has tapped him to be the head of the FCC. One recommendation that was made in Project 2025 is that PBS and NPR stations shouldn't even be qualified anymore as non-commercial educational stations. That's an FCC designation that has been in place for a long time now, but they're saying that these stations shouldn't have that anymore. And under that status currently, stations don't have to pay certain licensing fees, and the status also allows them to be licensed on what is the non-commercial portion of the radio band, which is from 88 to 92 FM. You'll find most of your public radio stations in that part of the band.
So that could be the left end of the dial, as they say.
Yeah, the left end of the dial. That could be a pretty significant change. Also, we know that Trump has argued that, broadcast outlets that are broadcasting news that he doesn't agree with or that he doesn't like should lose their licenses. Up until now, that's kind of just been bluster. But if he had someone at the FCC who would be inclined to agree with him on that, that could have an impact as well. So, these are possibly long shots. It's really hard to know right now if these would actually happen under Carr, but it will be a shift for the FCC for sure.
Moss Bresnahan, we're coming to the end of our time together. For all the grief we've gotten over the years and this back and forth about funding and bias, as painful as it would be, isn't there a way of thinking that maybe the system would ultimately be better off ripping off that Band-Aid without government funding being separate?
Well, unfortunately, the real impact of those reductions in federal funding will hit the local stations the most. Again, it's the stations, as Fred mentioned earlier, in the areas that just don't have the good corporate citizens and the foundations and the foundation of philanthropy to support those stations. Right now, there's a universal service for public broadcasting. 97% of the American public can receive PBS or NPR because of that funding for CPB. And if that were to go away, the universal service would go away. I think ultimately, public media stations have earned bipartisan congressional support for over 50 years because they do deliver. They provide really valuable educational content for kids, really important public affairs programming, the best in science and nature programming, classical music. I mean, when you get right down to it, it is an incredible return on investment for the American people, and it's an investment in local communities all across America. So, no, I think CPB is a great investment, and I think it deserves an even greater investment. That would be my response. And again, as Jenna mentioned earlier, CPB provides maybe 20% of funding for stations. Really, it's viewer and listener support that makes the difference. For us, it's viewer and listener support is 60% of our funding. And so it's a public-private partnership that works very, very well. And again, polls show that between 70 and 80% of the American public do support funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So I hope and believe it will continue, and public media will continue to play a really important role in the lives of Americans all across the country.
Moss Bresnahan, executive director of our producing station, Illinois Public Media, and my boss. Thank you for being with us today on the 21st Show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mike Jansen is an editor with Current Magazine. Mike, thanks for sharing your reporting with us today.
You're welcome. Great to be with you.
And Jenna Dooley is news director at our partner station, WNIJ, in DeKalb and Rockford. Jenna, great to talk with you. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Once again, that conversation was first broadcast in January. We're revisiting it today ahead of this Wednesday when the CEOs of PBS and NPR are set to testify before the House Congressional Subcommittee on DOGE, chaired by Marjorie Taylor Greene. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about a relatively obscure law. It's known as Section 230. A number of public officials, including our senior Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, want to repeal it. It provides protections against lawsuits for online providers. We're going to talk about the potential consequences of that. Plus, we'll have an update on the Flag Commission here in Illinois. Voters have weighed in, and at least from the people who cast ballots, this was not a sort of scientific or verified process, but among those who cast ballots, the most popular outcome was just keeping the flag we have now. So we'll talk about that tomorrow on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.